This afternoon, we thought we would both share some thoughts about practicing in daily life, taking what we've been practicing here and applying it in the midst of our busy and often challenging lives. And I thought I'd start this afternoon by following a little bit from the topic that Pam talked about this morning of thoughts, and to explore, well, first of all, you know, here on retreat, we do have the luxury, really, of exploring what it means to see a thought simply as a thought and not be engaged with the content of the thought. To set the content aside or just notice something very simple about the content, but basically come into the present moment of how am I now? What is here now? What is the experience of thinking? And not so much attending to or following or engaging with at all the content of our thoughts. And this is extremely helpful to practice with this in our retreat practice, partly because it helps to settle our mind, to settle into a more settled, still place. It also begins to point out that many, many, many of our thoughts are actually not terribly useful. So we begin to get the sense of that in our meditation. But we do have to think in our lives. You know, we are beings that navigate the world through thought. We have to engage with content in our daily lives. And so this is a big area of difference in daily life practice from retreat practice. In daily life practice, we need to learn what it means to be aware of content, and also be aware of ourselves. Be aware of what we're doing, how we're engaging, what we're saying, what we're thinking about, what our plans are, and how we are at the same time. And the practice on retreat kind of gives us the sense, or maybe the feeling, that mindfulness means letting go of content, and therefore, if we are mindful, or if content is important, we can't be mindful. And I want to disabuse you of that idea, because it is possible to be mindful while we are thinking, while we are engaged in content, not just in the way of knowing the process of thinking, but also understanding something about what the content of the thought is and how it lands. Sometimes I have the sense that when a thought goes through my mind, it creates a landscape of experience that can be known. Let's play with this for a moment. I'm just going to drop some words into the room. So close your eyes and connect with the experience of sitting and relax, receive. And as you sit here, I'm going to offer a few words into the room. And as I say these words, notice the impact that the words have on you. Struggle. Frustration. Really? relaxation. Ease. So you can open your eyes. How many of you noticed something shift with each word? Just raise your hands a little. Many of you. This is a single word. And you could feel a shift, a resonance, a something related to the content of that word. Usually related to the content of the word, the meaning of the word. And if you reflect on just that simple, you're pretty quiet. You know, you've been sitting for 3 days. Although I do find this exercise works pretty well in a meditation group too. That just a single word has an impact like this. Imagine how much impact is going on based on the content that we are receiving. The content that we think in our thoughts all day long, what we hear on the news, what we say to each other. There's a lot of impact that happens based on the content. And so this exploration of how does the content land? When we read something in the newspaper, how are we as we read it? When we hear something on the radio, what happens as we hear it? So this is an exploration of taking in content and then reflecting on, exploring in the being with exploration. How am I given that content has arisen in my experience? I've heard that thing, seen that thing, done that thing. How am I? My teacher, Saito Utejaniya, encourages in daily life what he calls 50-50 mindfulness. 50% of the attention on what we're doing, what we're hearing, what we're seeing, the content of our experience. And 50% of the attention on how we are with that content. This is very different than if content arises in meditation, thinking, oh, it's just a thought, set it aside, come back to the breath. That's almost like a diversion or a going around what has arisen based on that thought arising, on that thought, you know, what, when thoughts arise in our mind, there's often a complex experience that arises with a thought. So we can be curious about what that complexity is, what that experience, what is the felt sense, what is the human experience of having heard or connected with that particular activity or thought. So this is a practice. It's something we have to remind ourselves to do. It's not something we do much on retreat, actually. You know, occasionally we do a little bit of talking practice at the end of retreats, which we're not so much going to do here. But it's not a practice that we do too much on retreats, and yet it is a crucial part of our daily life, of bringing our mindfulness practice into our daily lives. And so I'll suggest a couple of things that you can play with. If you can remember, that's always the trick. So engaging with content. There's a couple of ways we engage with content where we have the option to slow it down a little bit. When we're reading things on the internet or reading things in the news, reading a novel, reading a book of any kind. We might choose to take at least, I don't know, maybe 10, 15 minutes at the beginning of sitting down to read that and do it, slow it down. At first, it may need to be something like this. Read a sentence or two. Stop and reflect. How are you? What's arisen in your heart, in your body? What are your moods? What are your emotions? You might actually take in at first, when you first sit down to do this practice, how are you before you take in the content? So, you know, you haven't opened up your iPad yet to read the New York Times. Okay, how am I? Open up the iPad, look at the front page of the New York Times, look at a couple of headlines. Already, that's enough content. Stop. How is it to have read that? What happens? Oh, the heart starts to constrict, you know, depending on what the headlines are. Sometimes it's joy, you know. I'll give you a little bit of content here. Michael Phelps has broken the oldest Olympic record. He has now received 13 individual Olympic gold medals, which surpasses this ancient Grecian Olympian from like 100 AD. He had 12 individual gold medals. Now Michael Phelps has 13. It's like, wow, that's so amazing. You know, you see this, you know, this Michael Phelps breaks ancient Grecian, you know, records. Like, wow, there's some like mudita, you know, for me. It's like, wow, that is just so cool. So depending on what it is, there's this resonance. We take in the content and there's a response. So take your time with it, and then maybe pick something. Pick an article to read. Read a few sentences, stop, and check in. How are you? How are you? What emotions are arising? Are you able to be at ease? Are you able to allow what's arising to be there? Or are you resisting what's happening? All the practices we're doing here, relax, receive, allow, be curious about the responses. Be curious about your relationship to your experience. All of that can be explored. And this is practicing with content. So you're taking in content and noticing, how are you? Over time, you can do this. If you practice in this way, over time you can do it as it's happening. You can be reading and knowing how you are at the same time. In the same way we've talked about receiving both breathing and hearing at the same time, we can receive and know content and how we are with it at the same time. When we're reading something like that, we're essentially taking in the content of somebody else's mind. You know, it's like somebody's talking to us. Only it's a little bit slower because we can control how fast the information comes in. Then the other side of the equation is around writing. Writing an email or sending a text. Again, slow it down. You might just say, okay, I'm going to try this for this period of time. Writing this email, write a sentence, stop, how are you? What's your relationship to what you are offering? In this case, writing is offering the content of your mind to somebody else. And how does it feel to do that? Is there constriction in your heart as you're offering something? Often that's a sign that maybe there's a little reactivity or a little bit of emotional charge around what you're offering. So again, this exploration, we can engage with content in this way. And it is hard to remember, but you could, at one point I was playing with putting little stickers all over my house to remind me to be mindful. And you could do that, it's like, okay, put a little sticker over your screen or your device. It's like, pay attention. Maybe that will help you to remember just even for the first 10 minutes of engaging with this. So this is practice. We are practicing here to learn what it means to be mindful. And we have to practice at home to learn how to be aware with content. If you practice this, it will really support you in being engaged in conversations with friends, with coworkers, with family, with the content that comes at us. It will really support you to be able to become aware and to use the skills and the tools that we're cultivating here that help us to be a little more balanced and not necessarily immediately acting on our reactions. If we're writing an email and we have the opportunity to feel a surge of anger come up as we write a sentence, it's like, okay, maybe I need to rephrase that. I think that's enough for me for now. You can carry on. We're going to ping pong here.
It struck me as you were speaking, Andrea, that we have, I know this is true for me, sometimes this very large sense of willingness to practice when I'm here. But when I go home, I don't want to practice. And there's a way in which if we can even translate a small percentage of our kind of dedication to checking in, to seeing how we are. And it's useful to connect it to something. Because if we try to do it all the time, get kind of overwhelmed or feel like we're failing. But if we can connect it to when I'm writing an email, when I'm opening the refrigerator, when I'm booting up my computer, to have that daily activity be a moment of checking in, it's the same thing that we're doing here. We're practicing. It's harder because we don't have the support of the container. But it took a lot of practice for you to land and arrive in yourself as fully as you have to this point. And so to imagine that that will magically continue when we go home is, silly. So I wanted to piggyback a little bit on what Andrea was speaking about in terms of thought and speak a little about conduct or behavior. And there is, some of you know, sometimes it's described in Buddhist teaching that there are three aspects or dimensions of the practice. They're sometimes described to be like a three-legged stool. And those are panya, wisdom, sila, ethics or morality, and samadhi, behavior. I'm sorry, meditation. Sila is the behavior. So wisdom, ethics, meditation. Meditation is pretty much what we've been doing here, right? And wisdom is both, I think of it as both the beginning and the end of the path. These three categories, excuse me, are reflected in the Eightfold Path. There are these three categories of wise view, wise intention as panya, wise speech and action and livelihood as sila, and wise effort, wise mindfulness, and wise concentration as aspects of meditation. So I apologize a little bit up front, but I've been a little bit on a soapbox about that middle part of the path, the sila part. Our conduct, our behavior, what's sometimes translated as ethics or morality, because it seems to me to be, in many ways, the part left out. I think many of us who come from a Western culture have a kind of automatic, if we drop the word morality into the room, you probably have a little bit of a reaction, because morality feels like moralistic, and it kind of can evoke a certain finger-wagging, judgmental, tight or uptight, restrictive, you get the idea, right? And yet, in the Buddhist context, sila, ethical behavior, it's a compassion practice. It's all about how we engage with ourselves, with each other, with the world. And so it becomes, or can become, a focal point, particularly in our practice in daily life. Now, it's important, I think, to get a little bit of an intentional reframe of how to engage with it. Because where in maybe the Judeo-Christian tradition, morality and ethics is kind of constructed as the rules of engagement that we need to keep our baser instincts in check. And so it can feel kind of oppressive and repressive. It's a thou shalt not, do not, do not, do not. In a Buddhist understanding of morality and ethics, it is, as I said, understood more as a compassionate practice that allows us to unfold and reveal our basic goodness. It allows us to align ourselves with behavior that is in alignment with our highest potential, our Buddha nature, we might say. So the whole orientation of it is different. It's not set up to have you be tripping over all of your mistakes and feeling bad. It's really meant to help guide you to be behaving in a way that's in alignment with not, Buddhist morality is not about good and bad or good and evil. It's about not doing harm. It's about recognizing what kinds of behavior of body, speech, and mind cause harm for ourselves and others, and which don't. And so when we take on the practice of sila, it's a practice of exploration. It's a practice for discovering in a very practical way, just like Andre was describing, as we watch our other kinds of behavior, what happens? What happens when we behave in a certain way? What happens when we speak in a certain way? What's the result? So mostly, sila is, we see it show up in practice in the way that we did here, which is that you come on retreat and you recite and say these five precepts, not killing, not stealing, etc. And those, of course, can be framed both as a do not kill, can also be understood as how do you celebrate and nourish life. So there's both sides of that. But there's also, I would offer as an invitation and a possibility, to begin to pick up those ethical guidelines and to begin to wear them in a way, like a lens, to observe yourself, to help you pay attention in daily life. My experience is that if you leave here and you say, I'm just going to go home and pay attention, I'm going to be mindful, like, all the time. You will be really disappointed quickly and discouraged and give up. So just in the same way that it's helpful sometimes to have a focus of your meditation practice, like Andrea was speaking about tuning the how that radio, you know, we're taking in the, we're receiving, but then we're tuning to a particular station. So we might tune to the breath or to sound or to sensation, not because one is better than the other, but just because it's helpful, kind of simplifies things. So in the same way, if you pick up a particular precept of, say, not killing, you can then use that to notice as you go through the day, what activities are you engaging in which killing is happening, squashing life is happening, and when are you engaging in activity that is nourishing, supportive to life, yours and others? And most importantly, in a way, what's the impact? How does it feel? So sometimes it's described that there are at least two levels of understanding or engaging with these kind of not killing, not stealing, etc. And one is what's referred to as kind of the literal level. So if it says don't kill, don't kill. Like, don't eat meat, don't squash bugs, don't, right? This is the more restrictive way. It's kind of a refraining from. And this can be very helpful, like even for a day, to try that on and to see what happens. And if we're honest, what we find out is it's really hard. Because part of being alive includes taking life. So there's another level of engaging with these, which is, I think, more useful in the way that I'm suggesting you might bring this home, which is sometimes referred to as the compassionate level of the precepts. And that's more of taking it on as a reflection or an inquiry. What could it possibly mean to be alive as a human being and not to kill? Now, as you go through the day, you can use that as a lens, and you might consider not killing as, what am I going to do with the ants that have invaded my kitchen? What am I going to do with that thought that arose that I don't like? Am I going to squash it? We could consider that a kind of killing, or am I going to allow it, right? When we meet decision points in our lives about whether to take action, whether to say or do something or not through the lens of not killing, I find for myself that if I'm confused about whether something will do harm or not, then it's good to have the do not as a fallback. It's kind of like a safety net. But it's also really useful for us as human beings to intentionally engage in the question. In other words, to be willing to not be so sure, to be willing to engage with ambiguity, with paradox, with our own confusion, because it helps prevent us from becoming rigid and dogmatic and, you know, and that kind of attitude is where the worst killing happens, right? And so it becomes a kind of humbling process, right? If we can unhook from the telling ourselves we're bad and instead be really open and curious as to what's happening, then we have a chance to begin to engage in our life with our eyes, our ears, our hands, our hearts wide open, willing to learn. If we take that stance, we're much less likely to become rigid and dogmatic and do harm. There's one other piece that I think is worth mentioning here, which is that in some way, what I'm pointing to is in the realm of what's described in Buddhist teaching as karma. Karma is often mistranslated to be understood as kind of the inevitable set of cards we were dealt. You know, it's our fate in life. But really, the word karma means action. And karma refers to every action that we engage all the time, moment by moment, of body, speech, and mind. And the understanding is that because we are so deeply and intricately connected, that every action is like a ripple in a pool. In other words, our actions have consequences. Now, you remember the part about not being in control? So the name of the game here is not to try to control the consequences. This will make us nuts. The Buddha is reported to famously have said something like, if you try to understand karma, you will go crazy. In other words, if you try to control the outcome of what you're doing, you will go crazy. But you do want to pay attention and notice the impact, as Andrea was pointing to. And more importantly, in a way, the orientation is not so much to control the outcome, but to pay attention to your intention. That is valuable and such useful practice, and really helpful in daily life. To pause and consider, what's my intention in sending that angry email? Is there an intention to do harm? Do I imagine it will do harm or not? If I don't know, maybe don't send, right? That's fallback to the do not. But if I have something clear to say, even if it's sharp and it's the truth, then maybe I send. You don't get to control the outcome. You are going to get feedback, and it's useful to pay attention to that. But you're not trying to manipulate what happens. You're trying to keep yourself awake and pay attention as you go. Again, often what happens here is that if we're honest, we start to notice that so often our intentions are mixed. It's useful to see. It keeps us from being self-righteous because we begin to see that, you know, other people's bad behavior, look, yeah. So it can soften us a bit in that way. So working with our karma, our actions of body, speech, and mind, by taking on and using any of the precepts that we talked about, not killing, not stealing, not lying, not intoxicating mind or body, not misusing sexuality, any of those could become a lens through which we pay attention in our daily lives. And we can also begin to pay attention to our intention. Not in a way to like get us totally contracted and afraid to do anything, but as a way to help us stay awake and to help us engage in the world in a way in which we're committing to doing no harm, even though it's inevitable we're going to do harm. So we give ourselves wholeheartedly to the practice in a way knowing it's kind of impossible. And that the impossibility is not meant to be an opportunity for you to be shaking your finger at yourself all the time and confirming your worst fear that you're really a terrible person. But rather, you make your wholehearted effort and you are willing to have the humility to keep watching. Oops. Oops. This is how we land in a really dedicated, conscientious, but friendly, warm kind of human experience that can, I've found, I've myself have done rounds and rounds of working with the ethical guidelines in my daily life continuously over time. You know, I sort of pick them up and work with them. Now that I get to teach them sometimes and work with other people too. Hugely valuable in my experience as a really potent practice for going home with. So I'll pause there.
There's so many threads to pick up on here. I think the one I'll follow on is the oops. I think sometimes people ask the questions about, you know, how do I engage with this mindfulness in daily life? And the underlying question in there is, so that I never make a mistake, so that I never get it wrong. And it's not going to happen. So one thing I think is really, really helpful is get good at cleaning up the mess. Get good at acknowledging there is a mess. And not that that's about beating yourself up about it, but just, oh, that again, that's the consequences of what happened. That's the consequences of those actions. And I really have really begun to appreciate this. There are two qualities in the Buddhist psychology that are in this terrain of the oops. They're in the Pali, they're called Hiri and Otapa. And I like Thanissaro Bhikkhu's translation, which is conscience and concern. One, the first, Hiri, conscience, is about looking at the past and recognizing the actions that I did in the past, those actions, you know, that thing that I did, that wasn't helpful. And there's a kind of a feeling when we recognize, ooh, that wasn't a good idea. What I did there, that wasn't so helpful. There's a feeling of the heart going, you know, doesn't feel so good. And the trick there is not like sliding into shame and guilt. This quality of looking back and going, oh, that wasn't helpful, is a wholesome quality of mind that helps us. You know, basically it's an empathetic response. When we do something that causes harm in the world, our hearts respond. When our hearts are unconstricted, our heart is like resonating with that suffering. It's like, ooh, yeah. Suffering caused, ooh, feel it here. That's Hiri. That's that conscience. It's a beautiful quality of mind to support us in recognizing the direction that we ultimately want to go, which is towards non-harming. And then the other, otapa, is looking towards the future, concern, recognizing our minds have this capacity to think and reflect on the future. What am I going to do? Is it going to cause harm? Is it going to impact others? And, you know, when we have that capacity to pause and look at our intention and look at what we're planning on doing and reflect, as the Buddha said to his own 7-year-old son, reflect before you act. Is this going to cause harm in the world to yourself or another or both? You know, so taking yourself into consideration as well. Is this action going to create harm for yourself? Is it going to create harm for other or for both? And if it is going to create any of that, refrain from doing it. So that's that quality of concern, of otapa. And again, you know, not to put it on as kind of like some, restrictive moralistic filters, but just reflecting, is this going to cause harm? What's my intention? You know, as Pam said, to reflect on intention. If our intention is not one of greed, aversion, or delusion, and we don't see that it's going to cause harm, the Buddha said, go ahead and act. But he did say, following that, he said, after you have acted, check and see, was harm created? Because there are times when we act, maybe it's out of delusion, or maybe it's just because we don't understand something. We don't fully see or know the conditions. We can't fully see or know the conditions always, ever. And the Buddha encouraged us to check afterwards. You know, even if we feel like, yes, you know, this is this email, I can send this email. I'm sending it with an open heart. And we get a response back that is, wow, that hurts somebody. We could at that moment go, well, I had a pure heart when I sent it, so it's their problem. You know, it's their karma to work out. It's their issue, whatever. You know, it's like, I'm not at fault here. You know, I don't think that's what the Buddha is suggesting. I think he's suggesting when you see harm has been caused, check out what did you not understand. When there's an impact that is not in alignment with the intention of your action, often it means there's something that we don't know. Something that needs a deepening of understanding that needs to happen. I see this a lot in my exploration and growth around looking at race. Seeing how my actions can create discomfort all the way to harm in others because I don't see something in my own mind. I don't see a perspective of privilege or power. And then I get the feedback. And it's like, okay, oh, I learned something. There was something I didn't understand. So it's, again, this isn't about beating myself up about it. It's like, oh, I want to know, I want to learn, I want to understand. So if we can have this kind of perspective around our actions in the world and when we make a mess, I think we would all be, there'd be much more of a willingness to engage with each other. So I see in the Buddhist teaching this lesson on intention and impact. You know, our first work is to look at our intention, but then we also need to watch what is the results and to own that if there is impact of harm, that there may be some part that I need to learn, I need to be responsible for. Your turn.
Yeah, I'm struck by the tendency for us to emphasize the do not side of ethical behavior because often it's not doing harmful things that prevents harm. But there is a flip side. And in the passage, the Buddha speaking to his son, Rahula, he says, you know, reflect, son. Before, during, and after any action of body, speech, or mind, and ask yourself, will this do harm? And if it's going to do harm, don't do it. And as Andrew said, he also said, you know, follow up, keep paying attention, and notice after. But he also said you could consider, is this action of body, speech, or mind going to have the possibility of creating joy? Creating happiness, creating goodwill, creating connection. And if that's the case, please do it. So there is this tendency to fall to the do not side of the precepts of engaging in ethical behavior. But it's sometimes described in there's what's called the three pure precepts, which I like to quote as being something like this: don't do bad stuff, do good stuff, and work to continuously clarify or purify the heart and mind. In other words, keep paying attention, keep doing your practice. Don't imagine you're there yet, right? It's an ongoing process. But we tend to focus on the first one, the do not. And there is this flip side, and it's part of what is really beautiful in Buddhist psychology, is the understanding that we can also, through our activity of body, speech, and mind, engage in what's sometimes described as decidedly do. Please do good things. Now, the tricky part, of course, is that we may think we're doing something good, and we may get feedback that it wasn't so good, so we need to keep paying attention. But the playing field is not all restriction, right? It's not all about don't. It also includes the opportunity to enjoy, be happy, to spread joy, to spread happiness. And so in the same way that we want to pay attention to our intention and to the impact of our actions in case we may do harm, we also want to pay attention to our action, to our intention and our action, and notice what brings happiness, what brings joy, what brings us closer together, less divided, less separate and at odds with parts of ourselves, with each other, with the planet. So this is for us is also an exploration. And there are lots of lists. You know, Buddhism is full of lists. So there's the lists of the Brahmaviharas and the lists of the seven factors of awakening, and there is the list of the paramis. These are all lists of qualities that we can cultivate actively, the decidedly do part of the practice, that could potentially do good, that could potentially bring the opposite of suffering. There's a word some of you probably know. There's dukkha, which is about suffering. There's also sukha, sukha. And all of the instructions that were given for how to work with the don't apply to the do. Meaning, don't just blindly go out being, you know, generous, and it turns out that nobody wanted what it was that you had to offer, you know? Like, you want to pay attention to your intention, and you want to make sure that you're paying attention to get feedback and follow up. But I just wanted to, it's like a heart. It opens and it closes. And if we only have a practice in which we are closing, we get very tight. It's called cardiac arrest, right? So it's really important that we also pay attention to the side of our practice that allows us to express delight, joy, wonder, and in some ways to be surprised by where those things come from. Because part of the whole of the Buddha's teaching was pointed to us because we're so mixed up, really, about where real happiness comes from. So we're not to mistake happiness, real, true happiness, for fleeting, pleasant experience. If you have fleeting, pleasant experience, please enjoy it. But don't look there for true happiness, lasting happiness. But please do keep your eyes, your ears, your hands, your hearts open and interested and looking around and testing out, just in the same way that you refrain, testing out what can I do that, what kinds of action, karmic action of body, speech, and mind, brings greater happiness to myself, to others, to the world. So I just want to make sure that we're balanced here. Your turn.
I was thinking that was probably enough.
That's not a bad place to stop.